that they can manifest anything they want. Where would you place that thinking?
I'm not sure. I think sometimes when they kind of are in that idea that they can make anything happen with their mind, that they're psychotic at that moment, but it's a very temporary psychosis. I think most people that believe that though aren't psychotic. I think they're neurotic. I think there's something that is driving their view of reality that is compensating for some feeling of inability that they have, so they feel that they have more ability. We'll get there. That's where we're going next. Okay. It could also be that it's right, and I'm psychotic, you know. Okay. So, Randy.
Just briefly. You want me to use it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I was thinking of an amalgam of the first syllable of culture, which is cult, and neurosis. And I was thinking, what about those people that are evangelicals, hysterical evangelicals, and then during the services, the hysteria, whatever you want to call that, that consumption into that feeling that they're talking in tongues, and yet they can visit that periodically, regularly. So what is that state, and then going back to the normal state?
Okay, so in my mind, that's not psychosis at all. That's going between functionality and the higher levels. They are able to change the boundary conditions and change their experience in a way that is helpful to them. Okay, the difference between, I get this a lot, the difference between psychosis and mystical experience is you ask, what is the result of having had that experience? People are psychotic, you have to take care of them. Or they run around the streets thinking, I am God, and it's all going to end, you know. That's not functional. Other people who have such experiences grow from them tremendously, are empowered by them, are enriched by them, are enlivened by them, are expanded by them. So the question is not the experience, it's how it's integrated. And that depends on your level of integration before you have the experience. So again, it's not that some psychotic people don't have mystical experiences, it's that they don't integrate it because they don't have anything to integrate with. Okay. And other people that have mystical experiences, if you read those experiences, you would think that's a crazy person, except that they are functioning incredibly well. Okay. Right, so Bruce, and then we gotta go on, right? This ain't the whole lesson. This is just a little part of the lesson.
So where does denial fall? Where is that fall? What category is that? Because I talked to something.
I think probably the next level up. Let's go to the next level. I think it's neurosis denial is a defense mechanism that neurotics use a lot. Okay. All right, so let's go up one level. So the next level up, and you see on the right, the further down you go, the more disconnected and isolated you are, the more distress you feel, the more agitation you feel, and the more lack you feel. So going down is bad. Going up, connection and unification increases. Contentment and fulfillment increase. So you want to go up if possible. Okay. All right, so neurosis. We don't use that word anymore in psychology. It's a bad word because Freud used it. We use the words anxiety and depression and mood disorders, basically anxiety and depression, and associated disorders. But in the common parlance, everybody understands what neurosis is. Neurosis is kind of that insecure person that's always worried about themselves. Okay, and there are various forms of neurosis, various forms of anxiety disorders and depressive disorders or mood disorders. But when you look at any of people suffering any of those things, you understand that the sense of self is weak. They don't feel strong, and they're not secure. Okay, that's why they have the symptoms that they have, or those symptoms are evidence of feeling weak and insecure. Uh, Well, one more thing I didn't mention is people with borderline personality disorder, that's kind of halfway between psychosis and neurosis. That's a very, very unstable sense of self. People who are borderlines, one moment they think they're wonderful, next moment they hate themselves and can commit suicide sometimes, unfortunately. Sometimes they love you and the next moment they hate you. The sense of self just goes all over the place. That's the hallmark of the borderline personality disorder, and that's between the two. I didn't mention that before. So, the sense of self, with when a person is anxious and or unhappy, is it's a preoccupation with the self that happens in neurosis. A neurotic person is always self-referencing. They're, even when they're talking to you, they're thinking, am I doing a good job? Does this person like me? Should I have worn something else today? You know what I mean? So if you could listen to their thoughts, it's always me, 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 me. And the minute you try to talk to them about something other than themselves, they bring it back to me. So the preoccupation is always with the self, and the worrying is always about the self. And the worrying never stops. It's always some level of, what are we doing with you? So there's a self-preoccupation, okay? A great deal of self-doubt, not feeling okay, and self-disapproval. There's a level of not liking the self, low self-esteem. So the boundaries in neurosis are inadequate. There's not enough sense of me here and you there and the independence of us. There's always kind of a feeling of being overwhelmed, you know, or unsure about where we stand and where the other person stands. Oh, I forgot, I should tell you something about boundary right now, just because it's such a good metaphor. Many years ago, I was in Northern California. A friend of mine had a therapy session with somebody that she'd heard about, and I don't remember the name of the person who did the therapy, but when I asked, what did you get from that session, she said, this. And I have used it ever since. It's really useful. We can think of the boundary between yourself and somebody else as a rose. A rose, like a flower, a rose. Okay? And the question is, when you're relating to this other person, where is the rose? Is the rose up your nose? Is the rose in the other person's face? Or is the rose halfway between? And the therapy involves moving the rose. So when you're talking to somebody about how they're dealing with their significant other when they're having problems, or their mother, or their kid, you ask, you know, where is the rose? And people can really easily say, oh yeah, well, there the rose is here. I'm feeling overwhelmed by that person. Or the rose is there. I'm bad parenting that person. I'm pressuring that person. So you can really look at any given situation at where the rose is. And I ask myself that a lot. Where's the rose when I'm talking to my, my department chair at school, who has my fate in her hands, you know. So I just wanted to give you that metaphor. So, a neurotic person, the boundary is either inadequate, it's not strong enough, there's not a strong enough sense of me different than you, or the boundary is exaggerated and rigid. A neurotic person sometimes, they insist on walling themselves off or keeping themselves separate from you, and they do it in a very kind of routinized fashion. And the most graphic example of that is OCD, where the boundary between the person and the world is always very rigidly defined. Oh, and the other thing about people who have who are neurotic is they're easily offended. A person that is insecure in that way, something you say is bound to hurt them. You know, it's bound to, they'll take it personally. And so they're very easily offended, and they're very easily hurt. Because the wounds that they have are so close to the surface. So that's the second level. Sometimes it's not possible to take people who are psychotic and then do anything but manage, to help them to manage the world. You give them medication, you give them supportive social connection and therapy, and they can work okay in the world these days with good antipsychotic medications. But frequently they can't rise. But neurotic people, that's what half of you are doing, right? Is working with people who are don't feel good about themselves and don't feel strong to make them become more functional. So certainly people that are suffering from anxiety and mood disorders, they can grow. Okay. So I saw one hand. Okay. Ryan, hang on. To do it this way rather than that way.
Horizontally. My first question is, what is the difference between someone who is neurotic and very self-focused versus someone who might be gifted but is very sensitive? Someone who might label themselves as empathic or highly sensitive to the emotions and experiences of others and maybe feel joy very intensely but also feel, you know, the pain of others very intensely. Someone who's very sensitive in that way.
The difference is between the second level and the fourth level. When we get to the fourth level, you'll see about the empathic person. Okay, it's different. The boundary is different. You'll see. Okay, but yeah, there is a big difference. Okay, and you had a second question.
I'm sure we'll probably discuss this, but you said that it's very difficult for people at the lowest level to begin to move high up. What is the process like for someone in a neurotic state or a depressed state or an anxious state to move not only to health but even to something like self-actualization?
Okay, so it's a huge question. How do you take somebody that's not okay and make them okay or better than okay? And the answer to that is has to do with love. Basically, people are neurotic because they got conditional love, not enough of that steady kind. And what you need to do is give them unconditional positive regard. Not that you approve of everything that they do, but you approve of them as a human being no matter what they're doing, and then you correct things they're doing that are non-functional. So what people who are neurotic have a hole where they should be filled with a sense of self and a sense of confidence and a sense of being lovable. And so you want to put love into that hole to fill it up. So the basic way you help people who are neurotic is you relate to them in a non-judgmental, supportive way, and an instructional way, and then you show them, you know, that what you're doing isn't really very helpful. Why don't you try this? It's a short answer to a huge question. Carol, hang on.
You gotta go to health.
You
stay stuck in the weeds here.
So you mentioned schizophrenia. Where does narcissism fall on that?
It's a wonderful question. Wait, this is not the only diagram I'm going to show you. Wait, I got two cool diagrams coming after this, okay? We'll get there. Okay. We got to make better progress. We got to make more progress, okay? So let's move up now from the self-preoccupied and insecure state of neurosis. Oh, by the way, we are complex creatures. We move up and down this spectrum quite a bit. Okay. The question is, where do you usually hang out? But Carl Jung said, I was just talking to somebody about this last night. Carl Jung said, in your functional personality, there are these little areas that are floating around in your unconscious called complexes. And when one of those complexes gets activated, it takes over. So a totally functional person who gets poked in a complex, suddenly they go crazy in whatever way the complex, you know, whatever. Now, another way to look at this is we all have wounds. And mostly those wounds are fairly covered over. But if you poke somebody's wound, they're going to go ouch in a fairly non-functional and empathic, emphatic way, not empathic way. All right, so let's go to the middle level. Now notice what's happening to these two arcing lines. They're coming closer together. The self is becoming more defined. So in the middle level, which is psychological health, the self is strong, it is well-defined, and it is integrated. That is, it stays basically the same. Other words that I put down are the self is consistent. A person who is healthy, you know who they are when you relate to them from moment to moment. You don't have to worry, who is this person now? They are who they are on a consistent basis. The self is realistic. The self looks at the world the way the world actually is rather than the way you are afraid the world is or that you wish the world is. And the self is durable. That is, when it gets knocked, it gets back up. Because there are hard knocks to everybody's sense of self. The question is whether you stay damaged by those knocks or whether the self is durable enough to say, hey, I'm still okay, I just have to kind of repair a little bit. In a healthy person, there's a great deal of self-care. Oh, by the way, all these words, if you like this and you don't want to scramble all this, there's scribble all this down, come up after class and take a picture of this thing that I wrote. Okay, in my notes. But you have to do that at the very end of class now, not, I have to leave right after the end of class today because I have a meeting at school. Next week, I will still have this and I can stay until 1 o'clock if anybody wants to hang around, okay? But today, if you're going to take a picture of this, you have to take it promptly. All right, so people who are healthy, they take care of themselves. They do good self-care, and they appreciate themselves. They have good self-esteem, and they are not afraid to acknowledge that they are doing well, or what they are doing well. So their boundaries are appropriate and functional. That means sometimes they have to have kind of a strong boundary, because they're being otherwise they'd be invaded or put upon. And other times their boundary can be much more permeable because they want to connect better. So the boundary is appropriate and functional. It can be configured appropriately for the life situation. Okay? That's a healthy person. Okay. So let's go up, okay? Because this is where it starts to get really interesting, right? Because we're all in the middle level, right? So what happens now? It starts to, notice those two arcs start to widen out. What does that mean? It means that the self becomes more inclusive. It becomes larger as we grow. So I use the word self-actualizing. By the way, I didn't use self-actualization because Maslow said it's not an end, it's a process. So people who are self-actualizing seem to have a stronger sense of self than the rest of us and seem to be more functional as a result. They do great things. Maslow said they're more efficient in their perception of reality. That is, and more because they're more efficient in seeing reality, they're more able to work reality. So people who are self-actualizing seem to spend less effort to get further. That is, they're more relaxed, and yet they do more than normal people, and they way do more than neurotic people. Neurotic people are the opposite. Neurotic people spend a huge amount of energy spinning their wheels and getting nowhere. So, self-actualizing people. The self is extensive. That is, it is larger. It includes more as self. It is inclusive, I said that. And it is expanding. The person who is self-actualizing is constantly growing. Their sense of self is enlarging. They are becoming more unified with what they experience. Let me do the boundary. So people with who are self-actualizing, they have a remarkable experience to completely open their boundary when they want to unify with the person that they're talking to or something that they're doing. That's called flow. When you lose your distinction between yourself and the other person or yourself and what you're doing, and you're totally unified with that. So they have that capacity when they want to when they're talking to you, to not be thinking about themselves at all. To simply be looking at you and listening to you and sharing your experience, being empathic. And that doesn't threaten them because they can come back to themselves. They don't lose themselves, they open themselves. But they can open themselves entirely. Or the opposite of that, when necessary, self-actualizing people can be impregnable. They can put up a wall that you can't penetrate because they need not to be attacked by you. So when they need to be strong, there's no way to dissuade them. They become irresistible force. Right, so, Robert.
You said that people who are neurotic just spin their wheels and do nothing, but I mean, there are geniuses who seem to be neurotic. I mean, Woody Allen certainly comes to mind.
Okay.
They move back and forth. Okay, there are geniuses that are psychotic, you know. But when they're in their psychotic or neurotic state, their energy doesn't get out. They're self bound. They're self preoccupied. But they can use that energy and create it. And in their creative state, they're self-actualizing. They're completely unified with what they're doing. You know, they. So Woody Allen is he plays this neurotic person because he knows that side of himself. But he has done amazing art. And when he's doing that amazing art, when he's directing movies, he's not going, "Well, maybe you should do this, Garland." He's going, "You do that, and you do that, and you do that, and you do that," because that's what his inspiration is doing. So he's moving back and forth. So that's the self-actualizing person. They consider there's more in other people and the world that they consider to be just who they are. They're not so me here and world there, or me here and you there. They're more me is us. And then at the top, okay, the highest level, which I called, I didn't know what to put, so I called transcendent. No, I didn't. No, I'm sorry. I put all-inclusive. Okay. So this at the top level, you see that it's way spread out. The top level is when the sense of self becomes all-inclusive. That is, there's everything is part of the same being, the same me. There is no boundary in the enlightened person because there's no other. Everything is the same unified understanding. And there's two ways to have that understanding. We talked about this. Ramakrishna, the Indian Hindu saint of the 19th century, the 1800s. Ramakrishna said, I want to taste sugar. I don't want to be sugar. What he was saying was, there's two ways to experience the all. One way is to stand in the presence of the all, to still be a separate individual, but the separate individual understanding that at the same time one is everything, or one dissolves completely into the all and there is just no sense of self at all. So those are two different kinds of mystical experiences, but they're the same basic experience. The understanding that who you are is thou art that. Who you are is everything. These are people whose sense of self is all is about it. So this is a risky thing to say. When I have met, and many of you have met, all sorts of gurus, sorts of people that are very spiritually advanced. By the way, spirituality, you asked the question, spirituality is the more spiritual realization you have, the more you realize that you are not separate. That you and what you are relating to are essentially the same thing. And people at the highest level of realization know that everything is all, it's all the same thing. The more, that's what basic definition of spiritual realization. Okay, so many of us have met pretty profound people. In my long experience with this, I have never met a remarkably spiritually developed person who wasn't extremely strong as an individual. There may be such people that are just like, and you have to kind of feed them, you know, and brush their hair because they're just in unity all the time. They have such experiences, but when they come back to themselves, they seem to somehow be stronger. So it's not that the sense of self goes away. I think the sense of self strengthens, but it strengthens in a much more empathic, inclusive way. Right, so now we need to go quickly to Abraham, and then we're going to go quickly to these other two little diagrams that we described to you. One of which is going to answer your question, Carol.
You know, this is a very fascinating model. Yeah. Very fascinating model, in my opinion. It reminds me of the seven levels of self in Sufism. You know, the first two deal with the narrative self, which is, in my, similar to the psychosis. And then the next three deal with increasing love and connection with everything around you. And the last two deal with the purity of the self and the pleasing self, the self that always pleases. And that's actually the essence of life, you know, so it's beautiful.
Okay, so there are so many models of psycho-spiritual development, and they're essentially the same. You know, they're all talking about the same thing, just using...
What's the one that he named?
The Sufi model, the seven stages. So there are all these different models. This is just one particular way to look at this whole thing. We got to look at two more things, okay, quickly about this model. Now we got to go to something very different, okay, because I have another thing I got to show you. Okay? What about this? People who from collectivist cultures, you understand that there are two kinds of cultures in the world. There are individualist cultures and collectivist cultures. Individualist cultures, it's all about me. It's about me navigating my life, me being happy. Collectivist cultures is all about me. It's I exist as part of a group, and my job is to help that group succeed. So we all used to be collectivists. We come from primate bands of maybe about 30, who all of whom work for the good of the band. But as civilization has, I would say, developed, but I don't know about that, changed. More and more of the world has become individualist. Supposedly, the current trend toward individualism started in Greece in about 2,500 years ago, and then it spread to Northern Europe, and then to North America. And now, because of the media, it's all over the world, and that's creating a lot of difficulty around the world, because collectivist societies are seeing their kids who want SUVs and don't want to pay attention to what mom and dad need. Anyhow, right now the world is
strongly tending toward individualism, but it still is mostly collective. If you look at Latin America, South America, most of Asia, Africa, you see collectivist societies where people define themselves in terms of what's good for us rather than me. So how does this diagram look in collectivist cultures? Basically the same, but the middle of it is less, it's wider.
So it looks like, instead of looking like this, it looks like this. The healthy self is more inclusive in the middle.
That's the best I could do to include, but that's basically, in your collectivist culture, you still are who you are, but your sense of self is always in relation to other people, much more than in, you make it or break it on your own in this kind of culture. Okay. That's the first thing, is just to understand that the width of the arc, the two arc lines is different in collectivist culture. Then the question comes, what about narcissists? Narcissists is very easy. This is both true of narcissists and antisocial personality disorder people. And people that happen to have both.
I didn't say that.
What happens is the bottom of the diagram is the same. But when it gets to the middle level health, then it stops. The two arc lines cross each other, join with each other. So some people who are narcissistic have a very strong sense of self, but it is very, very narrow, and it does not include anybody else. A narcissist always is self-referencing. No matter what they're doing, what they're supposedly doing for you, they're always thinking, what's in it for me? It's going to be good for me. They're always about themselves. They can't, there's no width to the sense of self at all. And an antisocial personality disorder people, a person is always thinking of themselves similarly. They're either they're psychotic or sociopathic, and they're thinking of, they're only thinking of their welfare. By the way, there are two kinds of antisocial personality disorder people that we distinguish now, psychopaths and sociopaths. Psychopaths supposedly is more genetic, and they tend to hurt other people for their own benefit in a very calculating fashion. It's hard to catch them because they're very smart and they figure it out beforehand. How could I bilk people with billions of dollars? Or how could I kill the people that I don't like and they'll never find me? So that's psychopathic. Sociopaths are more from their upbringing and they're more impulsive. So they hurt people for their own benefit, but they tend to do so without a lot of forethought. And they're, in a certain sense, well, they're both very dangerous, antisocial and both kinds of antisocial personality disorders are dangerous. Right, so those are the two little parts of the model that I wanted to tell you about. Anything you want to ask about this is just kind of provoking your thought. And then I want to take you to a different model, a very different model, but one that you need to hear about. So questions or comments?
Robert, hang on.
Yeah, how is it that psychopaths and sociopaths can have such a following? I mean, you would think evolutionarily we'd be tuned into rejecting that.
Because evolutionarily, evolution is a great thing and a terrible thing. Evolution has brought us to where we are, but in the world that is changing, in the environment that is changing, we need to accelerate evolution. Because some of the things that we've developed evolutionarily are no longer functional. They're models that don't work anymore. That's why we have cultural evolution, which is how human beings have accelerated biological evolution. So, all right, so the question is...
Why haven't we evolved to sense and reject that behavior?
Oh, okay. Oh, because... Oh, so that was where I was going. So the reason that we so many people are attracted to antisocial personality disorder people is because we have biologically programmed into us a preference for order in our group and levels of responsibility and authority in a group. So there's if you look at primate groups, it's an alpha. And there are some helpers of the alpha. And then there's everybody else. So we were programmed to respect authority, and authority is based in nature on strength. So people that we see as strong, we have a tendency to respect and obey.
But again, these people are often very weak.
Okay, I believe that the people we're talking about are extremely weak, and that's why they portray themselves as extremely strong. It's a compensation. But people don't see that. They see the portrayal of strength. And this
but why don't they see it? Shouldn't we be very sensitive to that?
I don't think so. I think that I don't think people are that sensitive. I think people look at the show. If there's a good enough show, it goes. You know what Barnum said? Barnum said, you can fool all the people some of the time, and some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. We hope. Okay, so let's move to the other model, okay? Lily, and then we'll move to the other model.
I don't think the term ego has come up too much. Would you equate ego maybe just with self? I, me, and mine?
No, I wouldn't. That's a great question. The question is, what's the relationship between self and ego? It used to be that I would have equated them. In Freud's day, I would have equated them. But now ego tends to mean self-preoccupation and aggrandizement. So the sense of self is a necessary thing to have. A lot of ego is not a good thing to have. So ego is kind of the overcompensation for weakness. The people that have the most ego are the people that have the most underlying distress. So you want to get rid of ego, but you don't want to get rid of sense of self. It's a short answer to a good question.
But the ego fluctuates so much from enlightenment, where supposedly you don't have much ego, to neurotic, where you have a lot of ego, yet you need a healthy ego in the middle.
So that's another way. Thank you. Lily, you're helping me refine this model. So ego fluctuates a great deal, but the sense of self doesn't. The sense of self builds as you move up this. And the people that are the highest have the strongest, most secure sense of self, so they have the least need to defend it or hang around in it. Okay. People that don't have a strong sense of self are constantly about themselves. People that are okay about themselves can pay attention to you. All right, so I think I need to move on, okay? Because we won't have time otherwise yet. All right, so the second, I'll show you. Let's see, me, neurons. Let's go with that. Oops, so let's see if we can make that happen a little bit more. I guess you could kind of see that, huh?
Yeah.
Because I don't think I could make it bigger without screwing up. Oh, I see. It's not very sensitive, but let me see what I can do. Make it a little bigger. Yeah, go to 4 feet. Thank you. And I just want to do it a little bit less. And, okay. Okay, so this is the second thing I wanted to do with class today, which is talk to you about the neurobiology of pleasure, because it seems to, in my conversations with people, it seems to come up over and over and over again. Aspects of this come up over and over again. And by the way, if anybody wants this, take a picture of this, or you just email me and I'll just send you this. And I just took a picture of something that I jotted down. This is not a very good picture of the brain, by the way. It kind of sort of the bottom of the brain. But it will get the point across. So the question is, what's pleasure all about, and what's addiction all about? Now, it turns out that neurobiologically, in terms of brain science, pleasure is a complicated thing. This is only the essence of it. There's all sorts of other stuff that I didn't put here. For example, we have in our brain something called endocannabinoids, pot, from inside our brain. And that has something to do with enjoyment in our brain. And I didn't include that. Also, we have serotonin, which has to do in our brain with a lot of things, but one of the things it has to do with is contentment. So there are other aspects to pleasure than this. But this is the basic aspect. So, when we look at any living thing, and I've said this to you before, so this is familiar to you, when we look at any living thing, we see that in order to remain alive, it has two jobs. It has one job, remain alive. And it has to do two things in order to remain alive. And this goes down to plants, or it doesn't go down, but it goes to plants. It also goes down to even one celled animals. It may go lower than that, but I'm no good at bacterial behavior, so I don't really know. But even at the level of one celled animals, this is true. The two things that any living creature must do in order to remain alive are, the living creature must approach the stuff that increases life, must eat, mate, make friends, increase life by opening, by approaching, and must avoid the stuff that would take life, must retreat from the stuff that would hurt it. Okay. So avoid threat and approach opportunity. Those are the two base motives that are in every creature, and in the human being, are deepest in the brain. These are the two basic motivational systems in the brain. So what's the avoidance motivational system? The fight or flight mechanism. And the fight or flight mechanism has to do with the limbic system in the middle of your brain. When, at every moment of your life, you're taking in a great deal of information, and that information is constantly being processed without your awareness, in terms of whether there is any threat potential. If suddenly a loud car backfired, and there was a loud like this, we would instantly go like that. Like that, instant. That would be this mechanism of threat avoidance being immediately activated. So everything that comes in is being, in the middle of our brain, filtered in terms of, is there any threat potential here? If somebody creepy walked in the room, go like this immediately. And that's happening all the time. And when there is a possibility of threat, then the brain automatically tells the body to go into fight or flight. How does the fight or flight mechanism work? The hippocampus, the horseshoe-shaped structure in the middle of the brain, says, hey, there's a potential for threat here. Amygdala, which are the two little ends of the hippocampi, two little almond-shaped structures in the middle of the brain that you've heard about a lot about, right? The amygdala tells the sympathetic nervous system to get the body into fight or flight immediately, instantly. So the amygdala is like an alarm bell. It goes, you go like this. And that's the nervous system, and then the adrenal medulla, the middle of the adrenal glands, squirts out adrenaline and noradrenaline, also called epinephrine and norepinephrine, because adrenaline was trademarked by some drug company and you can't really use it, which is why they had to invent the term epinephrine. But anyway, epinephrine is adrenaline, and adrenaline and noradrenaline come squirting out into your bloodstream, and they prepare you for fight or flight. At the same time as that's happening, the hypothalamus in the middle of the brain is telling the pituitary gland in the middle of the brain to secrete hormones, which then go into the bloodstream and cause the body to continue to also be ready for fight or flight. So it's a complicated set of mechanisms that happen, But the basic idea of this system is that in a second or two, well, instantly to begin with, and in a second or two, you need to be ready to deal with any threat. You need to be able to freeze immediately and then run away or fight if necessary. The important thing about this is because we're in a social situation, and especially in a digitally wired social situation, we are always being exposed to potential threat. There's always a sense of, even if there's no bad news now, they will find you some bad news, so they'll tune into the news, because we have an orienting reflex to anything that's bad. We got to pay attention to it because it could be a threat, it could hurt us. So they're constantly throwing bad news at us. I showed you that Steve Pinker video, which shows you that things are getting better decade by millennium by millennia, decade by decade, century by century, decade by decade. Things are getting better at all sorts of levels. But the news is getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And so we're constantly convinced that the world is a worse and worse place. And that keeps us tuned into the news and electing bad people. But it creates this constant being in fight or flight at some level. There's always something on our minds that is freaking us. And that creates the fight or flight mechanism always being activated, and that's what anxiety is. Anxiety is the fight or flight mechanism. And because of the chronic activation of the fight or flight mechanism, that's something that in evolution should have just happened for a second or two or a minute or so every once in a long while. When it's acute, it helps us. When the fight or flight mechanism is always happening, it eventually breaks us down. It's why anxiety and depression in the long run are not good for your physical health. Bernie, and then we got to move to the other one, because I want to give you the good news, not the mixed news. So that's just the first of the two mechanisms, which is the avoidance mechanism.
So what tells your body, if I hear the gunshot go off and I react, and then I realize it's just a gunshot, it's not bothering me, and so I'm going back to the room?
So what intercedes? When you tell yourself, hey, it's okay, that's the prefrontal cortex of your brain telling the limbic system to turn itself down. So there are connections between the thinking part you're using now. There are physical connections, nerve connections, neuron connections. Neurons are nerve cells. Okay, nerve connections between the prefrontal cortex and the other structures in the limbic system. So you basically can cool your jets. You can turn yourself down. Okay. So that's the avoidance mechanism, and I didn't even put that up because that wasn't the lecture. The lecture is the approach mechanism. What gets you to go for the good stuff? Very simply, after a whole lot of confusion on my part, I actually found out what the truth is here. So let me tell you very simply what this diagram says, okay? It says that when you experience something good, good for your life, when you taste something good, when someone strokes you, when you hear good news, the hypothalamus, these structures in the middle of your brain, the hypothalamus, the pituitary gland is the master gland of the body. It's right underneath the hypothalamus. So the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland release chemicals called beta endorphins. They are the feel-good chemicals in your brain. They are the endogenous opioids in your brain. They're the morphine and heroin in your brain naturally. Okay. They cause us to feel good, and when we're in pain, to have that pain overridden by good feeling. So, when you taste that piece of chocolate cake, it tastes really good, and that feeling of pleasure that comes from the taste is the release of endorphins into your brain. And the problem with endorphins is the effect of endorphins fades very quickly. So you have this piece of chocolate cake, it's so good, you feel so much pleasure, and then I still have no peace. The reason for that is when the endorphin rush fades, it stimulates the middle of the brain, the so-called reward pathway, the dopamine is a neurotransmitter that works this reward pathway from the ventral tegmental area to the nucleus accumbens. It's a little short pathway in the middle of the brain, and that pathway says, get more, get more. And so you think, well, I'll have another piece of chocolate cake. So it motivates you to get another piece of chocolate cake. So you take another bite of chocolate cake. It tastes so good. Endorphins are released. You're happy for a little bit. Fades real quickly. And you think, well, I'll have another piece. That's the reward pathway. And in nature, this works really well. Because in nature, that which is pleasant, that which gives you pleasure, is life-promoting. It's why you feel pleasure. By the way, because of these things. These things, the nature wants you to do more of this life-promoting stuff. So we have evolved the feeling of pleasure and then the motivation to get it again. So in nature, this is fine. But chocolate cake doesn't grow on trees. And heroin does grow on poppies, unfortunately, but not in the fashion that people inject it. Social media doesn't grow on trees either. So the things that we have invented, which give people a great deal of pleasure, a lot of endorphin rush, those things cause us to very powerfully want more. So we're tricked by the pleasures that we have created. It tricks the brain into being particularly stimulated to have pleasure. Much more pleasure. Boy, that orange I had this morning was much better than the orange I would have had 200 years ago, because they hybridized the oranges, and now they're three times as sweet. So I got a lot more pleasure from the orange than I would have gotten if I picked one off a tree hundreds of years ago. So we've tweaked the world to give us more immediate pleasure, but it makes more motivation to get more. So why, in nature, why doesn't... why don't we just keep eating the chocolate cake until we've eaten the whole cake, and then we go out and get another one, and why don't we just keep eating until we die? There are various feedback mechanisms in the organism that stop us from overeating after we've overeaten, but they tend to take a while to happen. Okay, naturally, they don't work very fast. What keeps us from overeating is the prefrontal cortex. The PFC says, you've had two pieces of chocolate cake already. Don't you think you might want to not have any more because you don't want to get yourself sick and obese? Why don't you put it away and you have it tomorrow? So the prefrontal cortex is always in dialogue with the middle of the brain, with the limbic system, with the reward pathway. And generally it wins. Generally the more recently evolved prefrontal cortex is able to regulate our appetites. You know, I think we'll do that. You know, we're able to do more of that. Or even though I know I would get pleasure from that, it's probably not good for me in the long term. So you're turning down that motive to get more. However, when you've had a bad day and your willpower is depleted, and you have that second piece of chocolate cake, and your prefrontal cortex says, that's enough. And you say, man, I've had such a bad day. I need more pleasure. I am sorry. I'm going to get a third piece. Okay. Then you go get the third piece. Then you're weakening the control of the prefrontal cortex over the limbic system, and especially the reward pathway. And it's really easy, given the pleasures that we have available to us, to lose control in certain areas of certain behaviors. That's called addiction. And everybody struggles with it in one way or another. So some people just can't resist going on the internet and buying something from Amazon because it makes me feel better right now. Some people can't resist internet porn. Some people can't, two generations of people can't resist going on their phones every 2 seconds because there might be something good there, you know. We all have struggles with self-control in various areas. And whenever the prefrontal cortex has lost control of a particular behavior, then it is necessary to either strengthen the prefrontal cortex again or enlist other people's prefrontal cortex cortices to help ours. That's what AA is all about, is you go to a meeting and other people are there and they and you have a sponsor and you call a sponsor and say, I'm gonna drink. And the sponsor says, no, you're not. My prefrontal cortex is telling your reward pathway not to do that. So when you're addicted to something, it's really important to make public what you're trying to change, to get somebody else on your side. Because you need somebody else's brain to regulate your brain, because your brain has lost the ability to regulate itself in that particular way. And that's what addiction is. And again, in nature, this works perfectly. It gets you the good stuff. It gets you enough of the good stuff. But in the pleasure-filled world that we have invented, this makes everybody go astray. So what we need one another to rebalance ourselves. Okay, so that's this little model. What do you want to ask about this? Okay. Hang on, Brian. Let me get you another one.
What are some practices that allow for the strengthening of the prefrontal cortex? And also, if you could touch a little bit on what is the balance between pleasure in a beautiful and healthy way and when it kind of crosses the line and how we should engage with things that do release a lot of dopamine and endorphins, because I also really like chocolate cake.
So the first part of the question was,
what practices to start?
Oh, right.
Yeah,
that was the good part.
Thinking
about that. And then the other part is how do you distinguish between
right. Let's do the distinguish between first because it's an easier one. To distinguish between healthy and unhealthy pleasures, you use your prefrontal cortex and you say, what's the likely result of what I'm doing? If I have been staying up till 3 o'clock in the morning on the internet, and I'm bleary-eyed all day long, my prefrontal cortex is probably going to say, you know, you're hurting yourself by staying on the internet so long. So the effect of what you do is how you judge whether it is salubrious or hurtful, whether it's helpful or hurtful. In regard to what practices you can do, sometimes you by yourself can re-strengthen your prefrontal cortex with regard to some habit. And one of the best ways to do that is mindfulness. You have to become aware of what you're doing and become detached enough from it so that you don't immediately do it. So I told you this before, some of you. The world's most famous addiction researcher, G. Allen Marlatt of the University of Washington, who just died recently, he used to use cognitive behavioral therapy. Cognitive behavioral therapy to help people who were addicted, but he, in the last 10 years or so of his life, he moved to mindfulness. And he works with people who have severe addictions to things like opioids and cocaine, you know, really difficult addiction, meth, difficult addictions, and he can get them to notice the activation of the reward pathway. I want that. I'm going to go get that. You know, you feel that, and he teaches people to sit with the impulse as it moves through them. And what happens is it moves through as a wave. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and then if it isn't acted on, because the pathway is quieting down, it goes away. And every time you feel the urge to smoke, and you don't smoke, that's a strengthening of the prefrontal cortex and a weakening of the power of the reward pathway to get you to impulsively act. So what you do is you separate the impulse from the action. So the impulse is felt fully when you're mindful, but the action is taken voluntarily. So you don't automatically act out of the motivations in your brain. You watch the motivations and make a decision about what's the best way to act. So, wait, what's
his name?
Say again?
Say his name.
M-A-R-L-A-T-T. M-A-R-L-A-T-T. G. Allen Marlatt. M-A-R-L-A-T-T.
So, well, first we'll go to Ryan, then we'll go to Carol.
Is that idea of becoming mindful in the acting of on different pleasures and different desires similar to the idea of Tantra and yoga? The idea of bringing consciousness to bear with these ideas?
Yeah.
Tantra is about the path to enlightenment that you take by paying attention to your senses, by being aware moment to moment of your sensory experience. So in order to be aware moment of your sensory experience, you have to be removed from it. You have to take a step back to notice it. So Tantra is just a form of mindfulness. Or not just a form of, another word for mindfulness is Tantra Yoga.
I'm curious because as this might be a neurological question, so the endorphins that are created from something that we know is pleasurable, so we go toward it, we want the chocolate cake because that's going to make us feel good for the moment, but is it my imagination or could the endorphins just come to you without you even knowing it, such as when you're on a break, hike, you feel high, or the exercise endorphin high, where I'm not really seeking that, but that just comes into me. Is that stimulating different? Like, there's no conversation with the PFC. It's just the endorphins are flooding my system.
Anytime you do anything pleasurable, you will get the endorphins flooding your system. Why you don't say, I'm going to take another hike right now, I think because at some level your prefrontal cortex is saying, well, this I'm satisfied. There's a satisfaction mechanism that is enabled, that you've had enough, like, you've had enough chocolate, you've had enough walking.
Is the endorphin hormones released sustainably and consistently and maybe even slowly throughout a pleasurable activity, let's say a hike, opposed to eating a chocolate cake where it flares up and then it fades quickly?
Thank you. That was a very good distinction that I hadn't made, but yeah, absolutely. If you're doing something that is a continuing pleasure, then it will continue to release endorphins. Whereas if you take a piece of chocolate cake, it's a momentary pleasure, and the endorphins fade, and then you want another one. But if you are constantly, if you're running and loving your running, or dancing and loving your dancing, you're constantly having endorphins give you the feeling of pleasure. It's a constant release. So there's no motivation to do more of it because you're constantly releasing the pleasure. Yeah, that would be true. And by the way, the endorphins aren't hormones. They're neurotransmitters when they're in the brain. Neurotransmitters are the things that make the brain cells talk to one another. It turns out that some of the neurotransmitters are also hormones. Depends whether they're in the bloodstream or in the brain.
Maybe my question goes back to the enlightenment that was being discussed in the other sheet, but it ties into. Here's the conundrum that I'm thinking of. When you're experiencing euphoria of the wonders of the natural world, I mean, you're looking at Mitre Peak in Milford Sound, New Zealand, or Vernal Falls, or in the presence of a 2,000-year-old redwood grove, or crossing the bar of the Columbia River, someone mentioned Washington. So those experiences are nearly transcendental, or they can be. And as Blake said, your doors of perception are wide open, and Huxley talks about that in the context of drugs. But my point is, when you come back to the mundane world, you come back to the world of we're making thin allusions to autocrats when you take over the next 4 years of our country, dealing with all of the horrors of that situation. How does one balance their cynicism vis-a-vis the euphoria they feel, which is right before our very eyes in certain places that Shelley talked about in Chamonix Valley when you look at Mont Blanc?
It's a big question, but I do have a short answer to a very profound question, which is how do you say okay given the difficulties of the mundane world? It's easy when you're in Milford Sound to think world is it's great, you know, and I'm unified with nature. But when you're trying to drive on the freeway, it's not so easy to do that. We allied with this. We have something called the negativity bias. Threat is more important than opportunity. There's a famous psychology article, bad is stronger than good. If you ignore a threat, you're somebody's lunch. If you ignore an opportunity, well, there's always somewhere else you can get lunch. So the brain preferentially acts on threat rather than opportunity. So in the usual world, the usual mundane situation, the brain is more alert for threat than opportunity, and if there is threat, it makes you recoil. Knowing that, it is necessary to become more conscious, to consciously decide to pay attention to what's good rather than what's bad. Otherwise, the media and your natural tendency will make you, the older you get, the more freaked out you get by the world. But if you say to yourself, hey, what's the miracle here? The miracle here is that I'm talking to another human being, and somehow or other, with molecules of air going back and forth, and we're sharing a life experience because of a mechanical transmission which has all these fantastic evolutionary components like hearing to it. It's like, this is a total miracle. So people that aren't blind to the miracles of everyday existence realize that the threats are minimal compared to the miracle of being alive and who we are and how we function and how the world functions. I think it's a total miracle that the apes that we were, the chimpanzee bands that we were the young boys go out and kill chimpanzees from other bands, how we have gotten to the place where we basically get along. Not always, but we basically get along until we blame them. So the short answer to that is you have to keep reminding yourself of what's real as opposed to what your brain would prejudice you toward focusing on wrongly. That is, even though the media feeds you threats and your brain naturally searches for threats, the reality is life is doing pretty well, and your life is doing pretty well, and you got to keep reminding yourself of that, which is why we need to work your practice. Okay, I got to get out of here, kids, because I got to go to school. So if you need anything, come get it right now. If not, I will see you next week. Okay? And next week I can hang out.